great news, reviews, commentary, not just another podcast.
Are you on the Big Bob Podcast?
Now here comes your host, Brandon B. of the World Team.
Welcome to the Big Blob Broadcast with all the geeky news you can use. This is episode 122. My name is Mark Swin. I'm a voice actor. You can currently hear me in the Machinima Project Soliloquy, which can be found on youtube.com/machinima and also machinima.com, featuring entirely music by Perimeter of the Void. And my esteemed co-host is, since I'm normally pitch-inning,
I'm Otherworld Steve. I'm a musician with Perimeter of the Void. And the other person you hear heckling me in the background is...
Still love you, Steve.
Hi, I'm Jack.
All right, so as always with the Big Ball Broadcast, we have an ass ton of news, starting at the top with CBS to launch Last.fm HD radio stations in four top U.S. markets. Internet firms help Canadian courts ID authors with controversial mail. Bruce Campbell in Spider-Man 4. Inuyasha, The End. Night of the Living Dead 3D. And all of this and slightly more on this episode of the Big Ball Broadcast. Stay tuned.
Demo Don'ts, Lesson 1.
Hello, I'm here for my demo, which is over 9,000 seconds long!
Yeah, we've already got him, but what can you do? Do you know the answer? The good news is, Kyle Hebert does and is now offering private voice acting and demo consultations. You can work one-on-one with Kyle and he'll offer his tenured critique to help you fine-tune your most important instrument, you. Send an email to voconsult@thebigbaldbroadcast.com for more info. Not a promise, but a path. Because the only person who listened to this guy was you, just now.
She's calm.
There are a couple of other things I'll just tell you when I remember.
He's crazy.
If you could not see the similarities in the personalities within like the first couple of episodes, you need brain surgery. I mean, seriously.
Can two people get together and record a podcast without driving each other crazy?
Slap.
Oh, you have to hit me so hard.
It wasn't that hard.
Find out on Anime Jam Sessions with your hosts, DJ Ranma S and Kudo Usagi. Log on to djranmas.net/animejam or look up Anime Jam Sessions on iTunes.
Weebertainment Weekly, the greatest podcast you'll ever find, starring Tombstone and Zach Jenkins.
Sure, there are better ones out there, but not starring them.
This is Tombstone from Weebertainment Weekly, and this is the opportunity for me to shamelessly promote my program.
You mean our program, right?
Yes, Zach Jenkins, I mean our program. You are technically the host.
Since you've taken over being the spokesman for our program, why don't you tell them what we have?
On Weebertainment Weekly, you'll hear the best in entertainment and media news, as well as my favorite section, Talk Nerdy to Me, where I make fun of guys like Zach Jenkins, who wish their girlfriends looked like anime characters.
Your mom. Join us every Tuesday night from 7 to 8 on WeberFM.org. Or you can join us on our podcast at WeberTainmentWeekly.blogspot.com or on iTunes under WeberTainment Weekly.
Those were the beeps. I must be Brett Weaver, and you're listening to the Big Bald Broadcast. Listen to it. Love it. Know it. Oh, yeah.
You are listening to the Big Ball Broadcast, and that was Brett Weaver, who can also be heard in the Big Ball Broadcast episode 119, now available on thebigballbroadcast.com with new and improved template. So, Steve, what have you been up to lately?
Drinking. No, seriously. Earlier today was my son's birthday party, celebrating his big number 2. His birthday is actually Monday, but we got out of the way today, so that was an adventure. Feeling a little drained. Haven't done a hell of a lot with Perimeter of the Void lately. We've taken a temporary hiatus due to unforeseen conditions. Hopefully we'll be getting some new material out there soon. We do have a brand new track featuring some VO from the award-winning Kyle Hebert over on Facebook. Search Perimeter of the Void on Facebook. Listen to it. It's called Arm. Pretty cool song. And yeah, that's been about it. What about you, Mark Chan?
Oh, now I'm Mark Chan.
What have I been up to? Well, if anyone hasn't noticed, there is a brand template on thebigballbroadcast.com where we're trying to emulate what a content management system looks like, but it's really just a bunch of WordPress blogs daisy-chained together. Beyond that, scripting is going to start very soon on Soliloquy, episode 2, featuring myself, Kyle Hebert, as the lead character, and... Scoring by Perimeter of the Void. I hope. Beyond that, yeah, just not a whole lot of anything. Just, you know, kind of reading around and watching the world slowly come to a fiery, fiery end.
And doing everything we can to expedite that process.
Yes, and also exploit it by talking about it on the show.
Yeah. Yay.
Unfortunately, we have nothing in the mailbag, but that's actually my fault just because I haven't had the appropriate amount of time to honestly edit the last few episodes. But hopefully I'm going to get on top of that within the next 2 days. As I said, 119 is posted featuring Brett Weaver, myself, and Jack when Steve had an emergency and Kyle was gone. I hope everybody enjoys that and all the laughter ensuing about Batman and crappy lines of dialogue.
And so, to clarify before somebody brings it up in the chat, no, Kyle is not here this week. Kyle is at a con, so you get Bitchcast again.
And again and again and again until we finally move the time slot for this show in which it'll be easier to get Kyle to show up. But yeah, just remember, send any MP3 comments, no matter how late we might be in the posting of the shows, any MP3 comments, emails, commentary, to mail at thebigbaldbroadcast.com. Also, while...
Yay!
See, you're new, Jack. You don't know. That's a mainstay. Also, if you happen to find any bugs in the site, just send them to technical@thebigbaldbroadcast.com, and I already know the comment system is broken. Guess who told me about that? Steve.
Steve?
Was it Steve?
I think it was Steve. Was it Steve? Yeah, it was Steve.
It was Steve.
Yeah, so we're working to bring you a better cartoon show. I mean, podcast. We call it Toonami. No.
We play radio.
Yeah, every single week at some time, Friday or Saturday, until we decide to publicize a change in that. So why don't we get to the metric fuck ton of news? Yay for bleeping! So what do you want to start with, Steve?
I was about to ask you the same thing. Let me peruse the show notes here.
Show notes. Show notes.
Let's just start with the silly, just right off the bat, and let's talk about Inuyasha finally, hopefully, coming to a wrap. Inuyasha, the final act. The television channel Animax has announced that it will premiere the 26-episode Inuyasha, the Final Act anime series, across Asia on October 10th, 1 week after the Japanese premiere on October 3rd. Southeast Asia, the Philippines, and South Asia will premiere the anime on that day at 8 p.m., while WIB will start the anime at 7 p.m., Hong Kong will run the series at 7:30 p.m., and Taiwan will debut it at 11:30 p.m. What this will all mean to you? It'll probably be on YouTube, translated 2 days later. Inuyasha, the final act, continues beyond where the first anime series ended and adapts a story from the final 21 compiled books volumes on the final 21 compiled book volumes of the original manga. The North American distributor Viz Media announced at Comic-Con International in July that it will acquire the rights to Inuyasha, the final act. Without sounding too smarmy, to me, feels like a very too little, too late thing. I'm sure there's a lot of people that, you know, may have some interest in seeing how Inuyasha ends, but after having watched it and watched it and watched it and rewatched it and rewatched it and rewatched it again, as it was just a staple mainstay on Cartoon Network for a couple years, I believe, I'm pretty burnt on it. I really don't care how it ends. I'm just glad I'm not being inundated by it constantly on cable TV. And having said that, since it's highly unlikely Cartoon Network's going to dish out any money for any new anime licenses, it's going to be one of those things where you're going to have to buy it to watch it. So you got to be a pretty hardcore Inuyasha fan if you want to see the end.
Actually, pretty sure it was made just to sell to North Korea as a torture device.
Or a sexual aid, depending on who you ask.
Oh, now.
Oh, dear God.
Already, not work safe.
No, I mean, you're right. We've talked about it a couple times on the podcast where it's, you know, what, I mean, where do you start? Anime is a dying medium. Yes, Cartoon Network doesn't want to license anything. Given. And they're well within their rights to think that way. I mean, at this point, it doesn't really matter because either no one's watching or no one's watching and buying. So it just doesn't justify the purchase. And even though Inuyasha is such a ridiculously popular series, which has spawned an army of super freaking annoying cosplayers, I mean, they'll buy it, but it's going to be released. I think it would be released in America in like really small allocations. You know, like it's not going to be the same thing as Bleach, where, you know, a store gets copies of Bleach, they're getting 10, 20, maybe 40 copies of Bleach. Inuyasha will just be kind of sitting stagnating on shelves. And at first they might go for the big push because they'll think like, oh, well, Inuyasha used to sell really well, and now that it's the end, we can really, really push for it. Except that's not really the way that it's going to work, because one of the things that was attempted was trying to release a cheaper version of the Inuyasha box. Like, I don't know if you've ever seen it, but it's a slimline box set. I think they only did it for seasons 1 and 2 out of the 7 or 8, and then they just flat out stopped because there was no double dipping in Inuyasha, because the smart Inuyasha watcher kind of realizes that, well, if you've seen like the first couple of movies, you kind of get the gist of how a season of Inuyasha works in its entirety. So why buy 8 seasons of it at $99.99?
I had to reach over to my Inuyasha collection because I was stupid back in the day, and I bought these things individually, got 3 episodes to a disc as they came out, got them all signed by Kagome and Inuyasha, Monica Story, and whatever the hell that dude's name is. It escapes
Dick
me at the
Cox.
Moment. Dick Cox, that's right. Yes, Richard Cox and Monica Story signed all of my season 1 of my first 2 movies, and I'd put them up on eBay if I felt there was a market for it, but again, it just goes to show you that the market's really shifted, interest has really waned. Had they decided to do this 2 years ago, it probably would have meant something, but releasing the end of Inuyasha now would be like the failed ADV saying that there's a lot of plans to continue with a live-action Evangelion movie.
Failed Evangelion movie? What? Oh, you mean the one that's coming out. I look at my cabinet, and I'm sure that you look at your super awesome sliding wall of DVDs, and you really look and you say, well, what's left? Or what's... No, not what's next, what's left. Yeah. Because, you know, I own Bebop and Trigun and Ergo Proxy, and I did have Fooly Cooly, and I have what I feel to be the core important series to any serious anime fan. And I walk in Best Buy and I see, all right, so there's Bleach. I'm picking that up season to season instead of volume to volume. And I mean, what's really left? What's important? And the answer is honestly nothing, because everything's so mass produced, dumbed down and sterile. And, you know, like everything's computer colored and they can bang out these series left and right. And all right, so the manga's over for Inuyasha, which means that, you know, I'm sure that they immediately were going into production for the ending of the series, but it took so long and it got so irrelevant after a while where it's just like, what does this filler really have to do with the story? I mean, okay, I understand that this character of piety needs to keep ascending to the next level, except I just kind of got tired of watching season to season, and it's just like, okay, and now it's Kongo Soha, and now it's this, and now it's that, and, you know, Super Saiyan Inuyasha, and now it's, you know, it just got so tired that I just stopped caring. So I really think that maybe the good stuff is finally over. Like, it's dead. It's really done. And now all that I'm left with are these collaborative efforts from different anime directors who really did have, you know, great series in the heyday, making things like The Animatrix and Halo Rising, things like that.
You know, it's kind of funny because, you know, granted, when anime became very popularized over in the West, everybody was snatching up licenses. So we get the tidal wave of some really, really good stuff. And again, perusing my shelf, Outlaw Star and, you know, all the Tenchi series and Fruits Basket and Yu Yu Hakusho, Dragon Ball Z, of course, Hellsing, Chobits, they really open up the floodgates. We get a lot of really, really great stuff. And, you know, I don't care if anybody pursues me as being cynical. I think I'm being honest. The biggest problem ADV had is they were licensing everything and anything, regardless of any cultural relevance. Just the fact that it was anime was enough for them to bring it over and dub it and release it. And it helped to really water down the market. And, yeah, we don't have those big franchises continuing on or introduction of some really kick-ass anime. The last great anime I saw was Fullmetal Alchemist, the first run. And, frankly, I found the new one a little boring, and I haven't been really keeping up to it on a week-to-week basis. I don't know if I've just become old and cynical or if anime is just not what it used to be in terms of like delivering really kick-ass content.
Well, I am hoping that the life cycle of anime, like I was talking about last week, which hopefully everyone's going to get to hear soon, kind of returns to that state where, you know, everything was small and communal, and like movies and series and one shots, they really mattered. You know, people would pour time and effort and love into things that otherwise would have just gone completely unnoticed. And it was because there just didn't seem to be as much anime or as much money in the industry at the time. Where, you know, like Production IG was first starting up and Blood the Last Vampire ends up being, what, all of like 45 minutes long. You know, great things like that and Tenchi Muyo and Love. Like, I have all three Tenchi movies and I can still watch the first one. Like, it's beautiful. It's amazing. The story plays out really well. It's well dubbed with my favorite Tenchi cast that there ever will be. But then I watch Daughter of Darkness, which, honestly, I really didn't give a shit about Christmas on Jirai. And then Tenchi Muyo in Love 2, which is just so shiny and pretty and in that Tenchi and Tokyo art style, which I just couldn't stand. So, I don't know. I miss the olden days. I miss the days when it was stuff like, you know, older Tenchi and the Eyes of Mars and, you know, the third Fatal Fury movie, The Armor of Mars and things like that. And when, you know, sci-fi used to run anime once a year for a week straight. Like, those were what I consider to be the good old days. And maybe it is because I am getting older and I am getting more and more cynical as time goes on. But maybe cynicism is what the industry needs. Maybe someone really needs to kick back and say, you know what, I do not need another Mech Fighter series. I do not need another Magical Girl series. And I most certainly don't need the end of Inuyasha because I just stopped freaking caring.
Well, yeah, if anything, this is definitely a wake-up call to the industry as a whole, both in Japan, where it's being written and produced, and here in the States, where the few companies left that are still licensing anime are going to have to be very selective about what they bring abroad because... It's been proven time and time again, the interest is waning. The well is running dry. So it's really put up or shut up. And I hope that, you know, Japan, of course, is struggling with this as much as anybody else. We still have this ongoing issue with piracy. Rather than get off on a tangent and discuss that, Japan has to continue to produce high-quality anime that tell really good stories and not just make it all about the jiggle factor. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. And the American studios have to back it. What I liked about the Animatrix was it was American financed. The Wachowskis wanted this to go with their blockbuster foundation that they established with the Matrix film and really turn it into a franchise. I think maybe we need to see more of that. I think if Funimation said to some of these companies, hey, you know, we'll put a couple million behind making a really great series and work hand in hand with that, that's probably going to be what it's going to take to keep it alive. I mean, shit, the reason we have a lot of great anime is because they made so much money with American studios having them do stuff like G.I. Joe, you know, growing up. So maybe it's going to come full circle, and that's what's going to keep it alive.
Here's hoping, but I think that the last big push for the anime industry is going to be serious attempts at making live action translations of anime series and one shots and everything. For instance, you know, first and foremost, Bebop. Because when that really does start gaining speed and hit the rails and the rails start getting warm, you know, what is that going to mean? Is that going to mean that I'll finally see a Bebop game? Is that going to mean that I'll see a revival of Bebop as a whole? You know, maybe a new set of stories in the series? Because honestly, they seem to have the right formula for continuing Bebop as a series. Just make everything before episode 24. Like, this happened between episodes 24 and 22. I think that's when Bebop the movie happens. And that's when the last idea for the game was supposed to happen. It was right between those episodes. So I think that that'll be the last push, because if Bebop does well in the same way that a comic book movie does well, then that might be the push that'll, you know, kind of blow the fire on the industry and maybe save it in its current state. But then again, I don't really know if I want it saved in this state. I'd rather see it crash and then see what comes out of the ash of that.
Well, what's scary, if the Bebop movie is successful, it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to change the face of anime from this point going forward. All it's going to show, particularly to Hollywood, is that there's already a plethora of anime out there, a lot of it very, very well done. Again, I keep going back to Fullmetal Alchemist. And just to have some Hollywood execs say, hey, let's license some of this older stuff, because let's face it, how old Speed Racer? They opted that for a movie. And Thundercats and Voltron, none of this is new stuff. Even Dragon Ball Z is way past its prime with a live-action adaptation. So even if Bebop is tremendously successful, I think you're going to see Hollywood opt to license some of the older properties than to help nourish the genre and really come out with some new stuff.
I just had a thought while you're talking about that, about, interestingly enough, Twilight. And just thinking from the Hollywood mentality of, like, what's marketable right now? Well, vampires are marketable right now, which conversely means that werewolves are marketable right now. So what if they made a Wolf's Rain movie?
What if they made a Helsing movie?
That's what I was going
to
say.
Yeah, like, what if they made Wolf's Rain, Helsing, Vampire Hunter D? I wonder what those movies would turn out to be. I mean, would they be bad because of writing? Because they wouldn't be bad over effects. They would be, I just think that they would be just bad translations because those types of series are slightly complicated.
Well, speaking about like Helsing specifically, it's a European-based anime. You have British characters that are central to the plot. So it's already kind of got that built-in westernization. It doesn't need that much of an adaptation. The reason you hear why things are westernized, you know, the word no anime fan ever wants to hear when it comes to a live-action property, you have to westernize this. It's because, unfortunately, when you're talking about a product coming from a foreign country, you have to adapt the script for it to even make sense, to be relevant in the Western market. If you have a bunch of cultural in jokes, it doesn't play well to a Western crowd. One series that did that, and I think did it quite successfully, was Shin-Chan, where it was incredibly Westernized, but it was still fucking funny as hell. You had this kid doing this crazy stuff and being very flippant and coming out with some of the best one-liners I've ever heard in an anime. Now, a lot of people can bitch and moan and say, oh, it's very far from being pure. That's not really Crayon Shin-Chan, blah, blah, blah. I got a laugh out of it. I thought it was great. So I think sometimes you can westernize something and make it successful. I think sometimes, like I said, you have it built in. Vampire Hunter D and Helsing, to adapt that, I think is pretty straightforward. And then you kind of take the Watchmen scenario and you use the mangas as your storyboards and you shoot from there. I think it can be tremendously successful.
I was going to say that localization over the years, if you just watch it both in anime and video games, has just grown so much. Like going from Sailor Moon, where onigiri were donuts, to now where if you play a Mario game, it's localized down to the Northeast region where there's a toady that wants a hoagie, which is something, you know, people don't always know what a hoagie is. But the only thing that scares me is, if we get these anime, like live-action movies, what's it going to do for the community? Like, I remember when anime clubs were five people strong and we'd all pull our money together to get the newest DVD. And then now if we do like a Bebop movie or a Helsing movie, is it going to bring people that haven't been in the community before into it now? And is it just going to rock the community? I just fear Twilight fans becoming anime fans, becoming fangirls, ruining things.
Well, you know, I drew that parallel when Dragon Ball Evolution came out, and I said, you know, are you trying to entice people over to anime by putting out this actual abortion of the property? You know, if your first exposure to Dragon Ball was Evolution, I couldn't see you wanting to pursue the anime and buy the merchandise and have all the fancy collectibles, because it was such a departure from what the show really was. And unfortunately, when you're talking about bringing some of the big name properties over to live action, you're taking that risk. And yeah, you're going to make a quick buck. Dragon Ball made some decent money the first weekend it was out and just spiraled downward from there. So if they're looking to turn around and make a quick buck on it, it doesn't have much of a future. Not at all.
All right, so no plans for new Superman movie, thus rendering everything we've talked about in the last few weeks completely pointless. With the formation of DC Entertainment, many thought a new film in the Superman franchise would be one of the big things that the company would concentrate on. Not so. DC Entertainment Diane Nelson told MTV. "We actually don't have any current plans for Superman," said Nelson when asked if the new environment and the recent legal decision regarding the character made a Superman movie more or less likely in the near future. We've obviously done a lot of great things behind the party in our history, and it's a key part of the family, but we don't have any current hands behind Superman," she said. Of course, that doesn't mean that there couldn't be plans tomorrow, but for now, nothing is happening. I don't care. At this point, I just have lost all interest. I never even liked Superman that much. I have never talked about Superman more in my entire freaking life. And before the show, I said on the phone to you, like, I really don't know if I want to read the story because I'm kind of tired of talking about Superman. It's almost like we're the Entertainment Tonight of comic books right now. And it's killing me because it's okay. So Singer had said that in reference to Superman Returns, that was his original Star Trek movie, and the next Superman would be Total Wrath of Khan, which I was kind of behind because, you know, it's Wrath of Khan. Wrath of Khan's awesome. And the fact that he wanted to make such a commitment to that, pretty damn cool. But at this point, if I don't see it, it's really not going to wreck my day, not going to wreck my movie experience next year or the year after that. It's really not that big a deal. So the creation of the new monolith DC Entertainment, which honestly doesn't change a single damn thing because it's just Warner Brothers jamming their fist up DC's ass and puppeteering them, which they've been doing for years now. When they say no Superman, I'm just like, I don't care. I mean, there are so many other series underneath the DC label in terms of comics and great characters and great story that to lose Superman, the person who knows no fear, has all but one weakness, two weaknesses. And the only problems that he has involve Lois Lane and deciding whether or not he can maintain a normal Earthian relationship because he's Superman, and if anybody found out that he was Superman, then they would kill her trying to get to... I mean, it's beaten and tired to me at this point.
Now, I don't know if the same applies to DC as to Marvel, where some of their properties are tied up with outside studios. But I think the only way a new Superman movie could work would be if it was like in a Justice League type scenario where you have other supporting characters. Superman on his own has kind of proven throughout history not to be a very lucrative prospect. And for those people old enough to remember, I think the only good Superman movie or the only watchable Superman movie is the first Superman movie with Chris Reeve. And then as that franchise progressed, it kind of did the Batman thing. And, well, it did it before Batman. It just got weaker and weaker until it lost all relevance. So I think to give Superman a standalone movie, to expect it to be good and not in the vein of The Dark Knight, which I anticipate everything coming from DC to be dark and gritty and brooding, it's probably just going to fall on its face. So there's a character that definitely needs a reboot, but a reboot probably 10 years from now.
Yeah, it worked for Batman in a really odd roundabout way. It worked for Batman because you start with Tim Burton's Batman, which was dark, but it was kooky dark. And then you go to Schumacher, who's just like, I think that Batman should be in a constant rave party. Yeah! And then you finally get to Chris Nolan, where it's just like, hi, I'm Chris Nolan. I actually read source material. So maybe that'll work for Superman someday down the line. But in the meantime, there are a ton of heroes in capes that I would much rather see. I mean, honestly, I wouldn't mind seeing a Blue Beetle movie or an Arrow movie or a Lantern movie or a Booster Gold movie. You know, just something lighthearted, not steeped in ridiculous amounts of darkness. Because if I have to face Batman, Spawn, Ghost Rider, you know, I'm just going to get burned out on the dark superhero films. I mean, you know, Watchmen had a lot of dark elements to it. There was honestly almost no lightheartedness to be found in Watchmen. It was so brutal that there were parts of that movie that actually made me cringe, like the fight in the alleyway when bones are breaking and they're showing it. So, I mean, at the very least, if they could come up with a movie that could balance those elements with lighthearted elements that I can really kind of get behind, you know, just crap that allows me to breathe. Like in V for Vendetta, like right in the opening there, and V comes out and he does the first speech, and it's like, spare the rod or spoil the child. He beats up the two guys and he goes, spare the rod.
maybe I'm twisted, but I just thought that that part was funny when he's like, spare the rod, and he's holding the baton and he beats the Fingerman to death. You know, that's funny. It's like Clockwork Orange funny, but it's funny. So if they could just give me something that, a movie that's, if you want dark because you think dark sells, fine, but just allow me to breathe for like 5 seconds.
Well, you know, the whole reason this question was posed was because with the whole court settlement with the Siegel and Schuster estates, DC has to go into production for a live-action Superman film by 2011 in order to retain certain rights. Although DC is saying now, almost cynically, that they have no plans to do a Superman movie, I think that logic's going to, you know, overtake. And probably by the time we do the next podcast, no, not that soon, but in the near future, you're going to hear, well, yes, DC is going forward with a low-budget Superman film solely for the sake of retaining the rights. And it's going to be utter ass. They might as well just call Tim Burton or Schumacher now and say, you know, what are you guys doing next year if we have a Superman film for you to make? So I wouldn't write it off entirely just yet. I wouldn't be too surprised if DC did something, made some kind of offering to hold on to some of those rights. And it's going to be ass because apparently they don't take the property very seriously.
You know what I think the biggest suffering point is right now? It was Marvel's loss of Ryan Reynolds as Deadpool. Because, yeah, the Green Lantern can be interesting. There's a lot of good stories that came out of Green Lantern comics. But Ryan Reynolds, I've always maintained, was born to play Wally West. And he'll never do that now because he's already been cast as the Green Lantern. But when they cast him as Deadpool, I thought, all right, well, I'll buy him as Wade because they're essentially the same character. Hell, their costumes are even the same color. And when I watched X-Men Origins, I just looked and I said, that's funny. I mean, he just walked in, wrecked an entire group of guys. And it's just like, all right, people are dead now. Like, genuine laughter. That's great. Out of a Wolverine film, even better. And then I suffered through the rest of the film with crappy CG claws. But yeah, I mean, I think that's the biggest suffering point right now is that Marvel lost Ryan Reynolds to DC because that was probably the last bastion of hope that they had to kind of deviate from the current market strategy of dark superhero films.
I mean, it's going to be hit or miss for the next few years. I think Marvel has the best shot of really hooking up all their carts to their horses and really moving forward. Marvel has a lot coming up with all their Avengers and spinoff stuff. You got Samuel Jackson, who signed to like a 9-picture deal. So Marvel's really going to get their money worth out of a contract like that. And you're going to see a lot of these things moving forward. And although Iron Man wasn't Dark Knight caliber, it was a great film and it did make tons of money for Marvel. So I think Iron Man 2 is going to rock. I don't think it really is going to get caught in any of the cliches in the first one. As I've said for a long time, I almost fear a third Batman movie coming out from Chris Nolan because it's not going to live up to The Dark Knight. It's going to probably be laughable in comparison only because so many people saw it and so many people are going to go to the theaters with these just extraordinary expectations from this film. And they're not going to manifest. It's going to be impossible to live up to that kind of hype. Iron Man, and as I've compared it to Dark Knight before, it isn't really dark and brooding. It has its moments of levity and it can poke fun at itself. I think it's going to continue to be a tremendously successful franchise moving into the Avengers movies. DC really needs to sit down and have a very serious board meeting about how they're going to move forward with their properties. And as we discussed just in the last podcast, with the stuff coming up for them, for their feature film franchises, they're not these tentpole pictures. They're not characters people are tremendously aware of. So I don't know. I mean, if you're a Marvel fan, the next few years look great. If you're a DC fan, I almost feel bad for you for what you got coming up.
I still say that there's good stuff to be had in the stable. It's just the market is so fickle because, I mean, you could really pour, you know, $100-200 million into a film and it could tank at the box office, but all of a sudden it's a cult hit as soon as it hits DVD, you know, in the same case for Firefly. And I think about movies like Tank Girl, for instance, which has a cult following. I love Tank Girl. And it followed the source material as pretty close. Not extremely close. Not enough to make the creator really happy. But I mean, come on, it had Lori Petty and Malcolm McDowell. What else do you really freaking ask for? And you can even forget Ice-T being in that movie. You throw on top of that, I mean, there are tons of films that are based on comic books that, you know, if unless you're told, you never know. Like Wanted, for instance, was based on a comic. A lot of people that I talked to about it didn't even know. Hell, I didn't even know at first because I hadn't read the book at that point. And then you have movies like Road to Perdition, which also based on a comic book. And yes, Tom Hanks was in a comic book film. Oh my God. But it came as a surprise to people. Like, really, a movie this good is based on a comic? Like, yes, it's based on a comic. So, I mean, they could pour the money into this. And the thing is that they'll immediately see a box office tank as, oh no, we can't do this again. We can't go off and look at the indie comics anymore to try and find good source material for films. Even when it goes way, way into the black in DVD, because it's those theatrical returns, even though the way that the model that they say the model works is that theatrical release is actually just one big trailer for the DVD release, in which the DVD numbers are really what matter. But considering the way that we've watched things happen, it doesn't really seem to be that way. It really seems to be like, well, if something tanks at the box office, then that's pretty much it. Like, they won't try to put money behind another property similar to that ever again. So I'm really interested to see, like, what is the next grandiose thing that they would try to go for in terms of a movie like The Watchmen? Because Watchmen tanked at the box office, and I'm not sure as to how it's doing on DVD right now, but if it goes into the black, will they go for another film similar to Watchmen, or will they just move on and try and find the next thing?
I'm looking forward to Kick-Ass, actually. Anybody not familiar with that, there's plenty of information. Google is your friend. Some trailers. And here's a film that was shot independently, and they got picked up by a major studio for distribution. There was actually a humongous bidding war for this film. But it's a film that's shot on the cheap. And you can tell from watching trailers and some of the scenes they have available, like on YouTube, you can tell it's shot on the cheap. But it's something where the presentation is fairly unique, although it's kind of Tarantino-ish. There's some really over-the-top violence. But it's the story. Again, it's the story that's pushing this project. It's the story that's going to really help this thing sell. So who knows? Maybe as a result of this big bidding war from all the major studios on this indie project for a comic book that almost nobody's heard of, if this turns around and makes some pretty decent box office numbers, maybe they'll say, well, it doesn't matter how big the director is or how big the talent is we're bringing these properties, or even how big of a character this person is in their respective universe. If you have a compelling story, it's going to make money. So we're going to move on. We're going to talk about beating more horses, and we're going to talk about Night of the Living Dead being remade. Zombie movie Night of the Living Dead is coming back, and this time it's a 3D CGI without any involvement from George Romero. Yeah. Titled Night of the Living Dead Origins, real original title there, the reimagination is being directed by a newcomer whose name I won't even attempt to pronounce. You know, the story front, this dude wrote the script, and he wants to update the tale primarily by bringing out the characters' backstories and make what he calls an American-style anime. Snicker, snicker, cough, cough. The latter will be done by using new technology the filmmaker is inventing. And he and his partner founded New Golden Digital, a digital effects company which develops cutting-edge hardware and software. The duo created and designed real-time effect system known as The Beast, which allows filmmakers the ability to direct CG performances the same way they do with real live actors. The aim of the process is to make tennis balls on a stick represent real people or monsters, a thing of the past, by allowing actors to interact with CG elements as if they are tangible. Now, the only reason that this duo is taking this project on is primarily because, regardless of what the producers will tell you, this movie has fallen into the public domain due to a copyright error, and they're just going to ride on somebody's coattails to try to make a few bucks. Having said that, I have no excitement whatsoever regarding that announcement.
I'm so ridiculously angry. The original Night of the Living Dead is just something you can't mess with. It's something you're not supposed to mess with. Like, just the ending, and just cheering when that chick gets smacked. It's stuff that you don't mess with. It's your childhood sitting there under the covers watching horror movies, hoping your parents don't find you. You know, it's shit that kids that wear on Hot Topic hoodies now. They've already ruined it enough. Stop it.
And if you haven't seen The Living Dead yet, which I find really laughable in today's society because it is a public domain film, I won't give it away, but as Jack just alluded to, it has probably one of the greatest twist endings in cinematic history. And again, going back to what I was just talking about previously with Kick-Ass, this was an indie film. George Romero shot this thing on the cheap. I mean, ridiculously cheap. It was all shot in just a matter of days and half-assed post-production, but it's something that struck a very cultural nerve. It's something that those who have seen it embrace it. It becomes part of you, and you want to, like, nourish it. But again, like I said, just to bring it back for the sake of bringing it back and origins, you know, oh, you can always tell what's going on with Hollywood and the mindset of people go, oh, okay, X-Men origins, Wolverine and Magneto. Let's do a Night of Living Dead origins. I'm so sick of the rehashing, and then the rehashing that's riding on the current buzz in Hollywood, that coattail. Now you're writing on two separate coattails. I just see disaster written all over this thing. And no mention of this thing's getting a theatrical push, so I don't think it's going to be anything we'll even be talking about a couple months from now.
No, I think my brother has the best story because I have two brothers and they're both a year apart. So they had to record it on VHS when they were kids. Go ahead and date that. And the tape ran out right before the ending. So, Steve, just imagine you're a child watching this movie and you're so excited and you're with your sibling. And then right at the end, right before the key pinnacle end moment, the tape cuts off. And they had to wait a year to see the ending. That is just rage that is palpable.
I couldn't imagine because, again, it's such a defining moment in cinematography. It's a way the director took it that you wouldn't think even imaginable by today's Hollywood cop-out standards. And at the time, it was just brilliance. It was a director going with his gut, no pun intended. He captured a moment culturally and cinematically, which I don't think can ever be reproduced and have it make sense or relevance to today's generation or even those people who are around to experience it then. We already have such a defined notion of what that's all about. That's why I have a problem with a lot of remakes, the Friday the 13th remakes and the Halloween remakes. I grew up with this stuff. I'm an 80s kid. I watched this stuff theatrically, and I watched it as it was repeated over and over and over again on HBO or Showtime and Cinemax. It becomes a part of your cultural identity. And then years later, somebody says, well, I want to turn around and cash in on this and make a few bucks. People like Rob Zombie who say, well, I'm just going to take over the Halloween franchise. It can't ever live up to what we saw. No matter how shitty and atrocious and cheesy and campy it was what it was. That's what put it on the map. Remaking it isn't going to make it any better or even turn people onto the franchise. It just seems like such a hollow excuse to cash in.
No, I agree. And the whole CG thing, it's like you have no Romero, you have no Tom Savini, which Tom Savini, who, for those who don't know, he's the special effects guy and just completely, like, he made zombies. And he did, if you've ever seen, what is it, Dawn of the Dead, the screwdriver in the ear, which is great. Like, what year was that done that he just had a zombie getting stabbed in the face and could do perfect special effects for a zombie getting their head cut off by a helicopter? And then if you look at Land of the Dead, which Savini, I think he oversaw, but didn't do it anymore. There's a part where this zombie shambles up to whoever the hell the mentalist is, Simon Baker. Thank you. And you don't see it. It just looks like a headless zombie. And then the head flips over and gnaws off this guy. And it's just like everyone jumps when they see that part, but you could tell it was so clearly computer generated. It wasn't the same effect like blue-faced zombies or just special effect zombies. I don't know. CG just irks me with zombies because you could tell it's so fake. Just some liquid latex is so much better.
And the other great part about the original Night of the Living Dead, it's kind of reminiscent to me of the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre, where it was a time where less was a hell of a lot more. You didn't see a lot of the money shot, so to speak, on film. It was left to the viewer's imagination. And, I mean, really, that is the biggest creep out. That's the biggest scare right there. You can scare yourself with your imagination a lot more than watching back something on film. And that's what made those movies really powerful. And then we turned on to these new exploitation films. The Saw movies are always the prime example for that, where it's horror porn, where we have to zoom the camera in really tight and show you all the insertions and incisions and disemboweling. And this is cinematic because we spent a lot of money with the effects department to make this look real. And now, especially with the procurement of CG blood, where it's ridiculous, where if you go see a movie like My Bloody Valentine, the CG blood is just so laughable. Give me Alfred Hitchcock making Psycho using chocolate syrup to represent the blood, and don't give me all the gratuitous gore shots. You know, play it off. Show it from very creative angles, and don't show all the gore and everything that happens. Again, I really have to get on my soapbox here and preach to this current generation. If you haven't seen these movies, if you haven't seen the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre, if you haven't seen George Romero's original Night of the Living Dead, check them out. I mean, that's cinematic gold. I think you'll really appreciate it for what it is. Again, just cashing in on that, shacking up your horse to that cart, that isn't cinematography. That isn't cultural relevance. That's trying to pad your bank account.
Yeah, I think about CG blood, and it is laughable. And then I immediately think of that scene in Shaun of the Dead where the chick falls on the pipe in the yard. And I watched the making of Shaun of the Dead just because I had to. I just needed more movie. So I watched that, and I watched how they made it, and they start with the fall and the pipe. And then they show you the fall in the pipe in CG, and they also show it to you in live action. But then they show you the blood. And you can always tell that the blood is fake. But for some reason, when you're watching it all by itself, it's not that funny. And even when you're watching it in CG, it's not that funny. But for some reason, when you see Simon Pegg and Nick Frost just sitting there, and then she falls, and it's like, and you see this horribly rendered CG blood spurt up and then slowly hit the ground in a way that's just like, it's almost like blood in space. I think that it served its purpose then, but, you know, nothing really, nothing beats practical effects. Like, I actually bothered to watch Fantastic Flesh, which was a documentary on Starz about the horror scene and about how, you know, before there was CG and before ILM, you know, there was just practical effects, and nothing really beats practical effects. I mean, even when they had blood spurting from a truncated hose, and it's spraying out in the most unrealistic way, that the movement, the unrealistic movement of that blood is still more realistic than, you know, full-on CG, we have a renderer to render water blood, which I guess is why it is that Kill Bill works so well, even though in the Crazy 88 scene you could tell that they're using colored water, which honestly I don't even think that most of the water was colored, because you think that you watch most of that scene, and at the end of it, the floor is amazingly clean, isn't it?
I've actually been working on a screenplay for a couple of years for a horror film that uses nothing but traditional effects and even some quite archaic effects. More as a social experiment to see if you can get that same type of response using the older method of doing things. If you can do the very creative camera shots, and again, not showing the porn gore and... just telling a story and having the story lead you down a road and allowing your mind to fill in those blanks. So hopefully one day I'll be able to report a bit more on that, because cinematography as a whole, I think, is experiencing a great decline. The Wachowskis, for all their brilliance with the first Matrix movies, they're like leading the charge with just showing people that effects can take the place of a story, especially when you watch a movie like Speed Racer. And, I mean, shit, maybe it would have helped Dragon Ball Evolution to spruce up the effects, I don't know. But effects can't sell a franchise. Effects aren't going to keep you relevant in the market. You really got to have that story behind you if you want to create a franchise. And I think that's why we're so passionate talking about a topic like this. It's a franchise that endures to this day because it was done right. It was something's done so right. Why would you even think of remaking it? I mean, Todd McFarlane talked about remaking Wizard of Oz, and the concept became so laughable. I think that's why we haven't talked about it in about a year or so. If it's good, leave it alone. If you want to make your own load of crap and try getting it on the big screen, more power to you.
I think that's what made Return of the Living Dead so funny, because it was like you could tell it was a parody, but it did its own thing, and Send More Paramedics is still one of the greatest sound bites ever.
I would like to actually close this part of the discussion by saying that I met Kyle at the Monroeville Mall. Steamrolling along on the horror end of things and the very sad I'll never get my fourth version of this movie kind of things. Bruce Campbell, Spider-Man 4, shooting in January, with possibly a villainous role in the works. Spider-Man 4 will start shooting in January of 2010. Bruce Campbell told Access Hollywood at his Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs premiere on Saturday. Pietro has a long relationship with director Sam Raimi via his lead role in the Evil Dead trilogy, made memorable cameos in the first three Spider-Man films. However, he may have a bigger role this time around. Bruce told Access that in the next installment in the superhero franchise, he's been told he has a major part, but didn't yet know anything about his character. The villain, or villains, for the movie have yet to be revealed, though some fans have speculated Bruce could take on the role of Mysterio, the Master of Illusion. The film, the follow-up to 2007's Spider-Man 3, Disaster, is due in May of 2011, right before the world ends. Yeah, maybe Spider-Man 4 is the real harbinger of doom. Anyway, there's been talk since, I think it was Spider-Man 2, that Bruce will be playing Mysterio, which I think is, no, wait, I don't care. Only because after Spider-Man 2 is kind of where I got off. I watched Spider-Man 3 in theaters because I'm a huge, huge Venom fan, and I just kind of watched Raimi butcher it, and I watched over a 10-year of two movies how he kind of screwed himself out of using Venom at every turn because he very actively stated, I don't like Venom. I think he's two-dimensional. I really don't think that character development befits him because all he is rage and an alien suit, and I hate Spidey, and that just doesn't work for me. And I don't know. I mean, Raimi is a very methodical person, usually, where, you know, he'll try and lob things at his fans to let him know that he still cares. You know, throwing Bruce in all the Spider-Man films is him saying, like, no, I don't forget where it is that I came from. I don't forget that I made Evil Dead on, you know, less than $20,000. I don't forget any of that stuff, which is why it is that in Spider-Man 2, the surgery scene where they're about to cut the arms off of Doc Ock, that they show you the point of view of the actual arms, and it's done in what's called SamoCam, which was a term that was coined for when Sam would stick a camera on the end of a stick with a blunt object, so that way the dark force of the Necronomicon could break through windows. And I don't know. I mean, Bruce being in the movies, I think has always been great. He's always been really, really funny. But the idea of him playing Mysterio, I don't really know. I mean, he's great in Burn Notice because he shows an entirely different side of his acting ability that that honestly I haven't really seen much of, because for the most part, whenever he gets cast in anything in a movie, they essentially just cast him for being Bruce Campbell. It's like, hey, you're funny. You do pratfalls. You're Ash from Evil Dead. Do this. Be your hero. But in Burn Notice, he's not a hero. He's actually a pretty, you know, dark and shady guy. So I believe Campbell could carry Mysterio. I just don't understand why it is that Mysterio would be included in Spider-Man 4 other than, you know, like, we're running out of freaking villains, which kind of brings it back to what you said a while ago, Steve, where it's like, why are all the villains so damned expendable? Why can't we, you know, save one of them, bring it back for later?
You know, not for just the sake of disagreeing with you, which would be fun in and of itself, but I'm actually thinking it could be a halfway decent idea. Now, hear me out. You're talking about a character who was cameoed in the first three films. I think it's a freaking awesome setup to have this person turn around to be a real fuck you villain, to say, I've been around for a while. I've been watching you from the shadows and in your face. I'm very well aware of your history and your strengths and your shortcomings, and this is how I plan to exploit them. So if it's done in that vein, it could be really, really interesting. If it's done as a cop-out just because Randy's throwing him a bone and wants to give him some screen time and it really doesn't pan out, I don't leave my words. But if he's going to play a major villain and he has some history and backstory, that'd be awesome. Now, also keep in mind, too, the guy who was cast as Uncle Ben's murderer has also came out at Comic-Con and said that his role is being reprised and possibly expanded. So it really lends more credence to the Mysterio angle, although it'll really, really destroy any canon that it has to the Spider-Man universe. I think at this point, as superhero fans, we've pretty much agreed that canon has gone out the window for these franchises anyway. So give me that unique angle. Give me that. Like I said, I've been around for a while. I've been watching you. The fans are aware that I've been watching you. How are we going to move forward with this? It can be really interesting.
Well, I think the idea of Bruce's character, like the ring announcer, the snooty usher, and what was he in Spider-Man 3?
That's a good question. It's a movie I saw once, and I don't recall. Yeah. I'm not going to watch it again for the sake of finding that out.
But if that is kind of a snowballing of like, oh yeah, I've been watching you from the shadows and I'm slowly going to destroy you because I've always known that you were Peter Parker. I mean, that could be interesting, but I think that they would be that Raimi, when I say Raimi, I mean that Sam and Ted Raimi, since they both write the films. And for those who don't know who Ted Raimi is, Juxor the Mighty. Anybody who remembers that, you're a dork. I think that they would go, I think they'd approach it more from a vein of like old Batman, where Batman sort of kind of had a hand in creating just about every one of his villains. You know, like, I couldn't save the guy who became the Joker in time. I couldn't stop that guy who threw acid on Harvey's face. You know, crap like that, where it's just like, man, you're the worst superhero ever. I think that they would approach it more like that, and that would be kind of an interesting thing, because then, of course, that would really stroke Raimi in a sense of, well, why don't we stroke my sense of making Spidey dark and tortured? Now he has to carry the fact that he created a villain. Oh, no. Because nobody really cared about Eddie Brock, especially not when he's being played by that 70s guy.
It's almost like Raimi went into Spider-Man saying, how can I ensure this character will never be used again? Will never be taken seriously again? And you know, when Spider-Man 3 was, I believe it was when it first debuted theatrically, there was a lot of talk about, oh yeah, there's going to be a Venom movie too, just wait and see. And again, it's a topic we haven't touched on in the podcast in well over a year, because that character's damaged goods. So, yeah, I wish the franchises would stop doing that. I'm really, really, really happy with the way Dark Knight ended, because the Joker wasn't dead. Fucking surprise. You know, he's a superhero movie where the villain lived till the end. If only the actor did, things may have gone a little differently. So now, you know, granted, Warner Brothers isn't quite the pickle on how to pursue their franchise, because no matter what they do at this point, nobody's going to be happy. If you reprise the Joker, people aren't going to be happy because it's not Ledger doing it. And if you don't bring the Joker back, people are going to say, well, you have such a strong character with someone's history, you have to bring him back. I don't want to see Marvel take that same route, especially with Spider-Man's villain gallery, to say, well, either you're expendable or we can kill you off, like the first Green Goblin and the second Green Goblin in the movies, and Sandman. You can't set up these disposable characters because they're part of the history and they're part of the continued whole rogue thing. It's not like Spider-Man defeats one villain then moves on to the next and there's nothing ever coming back. There's no repercussions. I do have a problem with Dark Knight, though, now that I think of it, with Harvey Dent, with them saying he's dead and he's not coming back and that's how the script was written. I kind of call shenanigans on that, because I'm pretty sure he's going to come back for the third installment. But if you have a strong enough villain, if they were to wait this time and then introduce Venom, something I can see taking off an arc where you can do another two or three films just with this one villain in place. I mean, it worked out pretty well for Star Wars. We had Darth freaking Vader, who is the antagonist for the franchise, you know, at least for the classic trilogy, he was the antagonist. Why superhero films don't take a note from that and say, hey, let's just really establish a really great relationship between the hero and the villain and mature this over a few shows, installments. To me, anyway, as a comic book geek and a paying film-going audience member, I think that's the most bang for my buck. But it's to introduce people for the sake of having new action figures on the shelves, which, of course, is the studio's main intent. Mark said earlier that the movies are just a 2-hour to 3-hour commercial for the DVD. That's partially true. The commercials for all the associated merchandise, that's where the money comes from. Granted, Hollywood can and will make a lot of money from a theatrical release, but you going out and buying, you know, the Wolverine razor blades and the Slurpees at 7-Eleven, that's a lot of bang for their buck as well. So I do understand why they do it. I'm saying my gripe is let's stick to a story. Let's have some continuity. Let's really mature these things and make my pee-pee get hard, I guess.
I don't know, Steve. We over here have a theory that the reason that they have to kill all superhero villains in movies, in superhero movies, is because that is why Heath Ledger actually died, because the Joker lived.
Weird thing for me to try to process right now.
Just take it in. Think about it, people.
Yeah, we're going to hell.
I was tempted to just put this whole podcast on hold so I can go ahead and see if that's true, but...
Let's see. Jack Nicholson lives, but the Joker died at the end of the Tim Burton Batman film, didn't he?
Yes.
Yeah, see? Nolan killed Heath Ledger.
Yeah.
We haven't heard from conspiracy theorist Steve in a while.
That's because Steve's trying to stay off the radar. I'm in enough trouble.
Yeah, how's your G1 doing?
My G1 is doing just fine, thank you. Actually, you know, I was almost a hypocrite a couple of days ago. There's a new root installer that's out for the Cupcake build. Real easy, one blink, literally. Visit one browser, run your G1, hit a button, it'll root your phone. Well, I'm tempted to do that. I don't know. I'm afraid to break it, but I'm certainly tempted to do it.
No, I'll just stick with Cupcake. I'm good on Cupcake. I don't need Donut, I don't think, unless Donut's really awesome.
If Donut brings multi-touch, I'll be happy.
I don't know. Because everything, like, multi-touch is now the new novelty of touch technology, where, like, I don't know if you read this recently, but Wacom, or as everyone else knows it, Wacom is re-releasing the Bamboo tablet with multi-touch functionality. But you're just supposed to draw on the thing, so why do you need to touch it on multiple points on this freaking pet? I don't know.
With the phone, I think it's pretty interesting because you can drag to stretch. I think is pretty cool because, especially web browsing, as I'm sure you can attest to, it's not native like it is looking at it on your monitor for your PC. So to be able to touch a point and touch another point and drag to stretch to your screen or whatever with images or the site as a whole, to bring that dimension of versatility to it, I'm pretty excited about. Will it be like everything really cool, like when Cupcake first came out and said, look, now you can do all kind of cool shit? Probably not. But that's why I'm happy with the simple things. If Donut just gave me the touch thing, I'd be happy.
Yeah, we'll see. I think we should both do a test of it, and then we can actually have like a technical review as to whether or not people who own a G1 should actually bother to try and break their G1 just for multi-touch. Coming soon on the Big World Broadcast. Anyway, internet firms help Canadian courts ID authors of controversial email. Think you can be anonymous online? Most people simply have no idea how easy it is for law enforcement officials and other litigants, like someone suing you, to gain access to personal email, Google searches, and other online information users think is theirs. The latest ominous evidence of this fact comes from our friends in the North. A Canadian court has ordered Google to turn over the identities of anonymous Gmail users who had accused York University faculty members of fraud and dishonesty. Like similar cases in the U.S., the York incident shows just how easy it is for courts to allow authorities to gain access to our personal information. People need to know that very little information that they give or make available to third parties, like Google, is unavailable to the government or private litigants, says Eric Goldman, director of High Tech Law Institute in Santa Clara University School of Law. I think most people are surprised at how relatively easy it is for government and private litigants to obtain their information. All of this constantly in quotations. When York announced its hiring of Martin Singer in January as the first dean of its new Faculty of Liberal Arts and Professional Studies, the university called the professor a renowned scholar of Chinese history and quoted university president, I don't even know how to say his name. It quoted the university president, pulling a Steve, as saying York University is fortunate to have attracted such a strong scholar and administrator. Shortly thereafter, someone circulated an email from an account belonging to a group called York Faculty Concerned About the Future of York University, among members of the community accusing Singer of lying about scholarly credentials and accusing the director of perpetrating an outrageous fraud. The anonymous group called for the president's resignation and a new search for a dean, according to Canada's National Post. Last month, neither of the ISPs opposed to the court order requiring them to turn over the contact information of the persons who used a Gmail account. This past week, Justice George R. Strathy of Ontario Superior Court called the orders a reasonable balance between protecting freedom of speech and protection from libel, according to the paper. Google search queries obtained by court-ordered warrants have been used in numerous criminal cases, including the recent cases of a Florida man who was convicted of murder based on evidence that included his own Google research, which included searching for terms like trauma, cases, gunshot, right chest. No matter how many precautions we take to remain private or cloak our identity, the authorities and other potential litigants usually have a difficulty obtaining this content. And they do it not by nefarious means like hacking, but through our very own court system. Internet users everywhere would do well to take heed. Your emails, maybe even your Google searches, could be one subpoena away from the prying eyes of federal authorities, not to mention private litigants. Big Brother's watching, Steve.
Well, you know, it's funny. You know, Google is evil. Google is the axis of all evil. And yeah, I'm kind of starting to lean that way. At one point, Google was applauded for being one of the holdouts when the federal government here in the United States was requesting some information. And they said, no, we don't share that data. And companies like AT&T and AOL did. They fully complied with the government's request and turned over all this data that the users thought was anonymous. For Google to go ahead and to provide this information, it's a little scary. Big Brother, yes, indeed. But I also think that people need to understand that anytime you're using your personal mobile device, you're using your cell phone, and you're shooting emails or texting, in a lot of cases even talking to people on the phone, it's being monitored, it's being recorded. Call me paranoid, but do your research. Look into what the United States government has allowed through the creation and ongoing usage of the Patriot Act. You'd kind of have to be a fool in today's society to think you have that anonymity. And it's because of the sense of anonymity that a lot of people do the crazy, stupid shit they do online anyway, calling people out and calling people names and starting fights and being homophobic and being racist and threatening to go shoot up or bomb your school. All these little punks do it under that guise of anonymity. I'm using an assumed name online. They'll never know who I am. Well, maybe it's about time some of these people get smacked down. If you pose a legitimate threat to somebody's health and safety, I think, yeah, the ISP should be able to take you down in a heartbeat. If you're being critical about somebody in a public forum, not so much. I think especially, and I believe this happened in the UK, but with us as Americans, I believe that we do have that freedom to talk about things that piss us off, especially if there's some validity to it, to say, I don't believe with your practices and I don't believe what you're doing with my money is appropriate. I think I should have that opportunity to be able to discuss that in an open forum without repercussion. If these organizations want to establish lawsuits and use the ISP or the search engines or email providers' information to be able to hunt these people down and prosecute them, that's a real gray area. The one thing that I haven't caught wind of yet is a huge backlash from human rights organizations. Haven't, you know, quite seen this become a big headline issue yet. I think if it happens in the States, yeah, it really will. So it'll be interesting to see how this all pans out. That crap I don't think is going to fly over here. And if it does, I'll say it right now. I'll just stop using Google as my email provider.
Well, this isn't the first geographically close case of this. I mean, Google, Yahoo, AOL, they've all been subpoenaed for information. And for a while, Google was taking the stance of like, you know what, we're just a medium by which people search. We're not responsible for these people. And honestly, I mean, what about what it is that they search is so ridiculously relevant to, you know, your court case? But they have been growing more and more cooperative, as opposed to Yahoo, which just folded like a chair when they've been, you know, subpoenaed for information. You throw on top of that, I mean, okay, so speaking beyond what's domestic, I mean, when you look at a country that has its in and out information on more of a lockdown like China, I'm sure you remember the story where a journalist was visiting China, talked about the Great Wall, but he talked about it poorly. It's just like, it's a big pile of bricks. Who really cares? It's not really an attraction. It's not like freaking Disney World over here. And they throw him in jail. So, I mean, the ISPs and the email providers and the search engines, they do hold a certain responsibility when it comes to you know, just like being responsible for what it is that people are using them as a medium to search for. Honestly, I just had to deal with a case where essentially I had to provide certain information to an agent of an enforcement agency about a post that was made on a website. I have to keep this really vague. A post that was made on a website essentially where the person had asked an online forum, "My friend wants to hire a hitman. How do you think he should do it?" And I'm kind of sitting there like, it was almost surreal just thinking, is this really happening? Was this person actually dumb enough to think that he had privacy on an online forum and where the posts aren't shielded from things like Google, Yahoo, or whatever the hell the Microsoft search engine's called? Yeah, you know, like it showed up in all of those search results, and this agent pretty much called me up and he said, "I need information on this person. I need as much information as I can gather, as it's a time critical situation. This could be a matter of life and death, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera." I had to send him over to our legal department so that we could release the information, and there was no struggle, there was no fight. We weren't sitting there going, "No, we can't release that information." It's like, no, we're faced with law enforcement now, where someone could freaking die, so of course. And in cases like that, I absolutely believe, like, yeah, in terms of litigation and when someone's going, like, when their life is at stake, go ahead, release the information. But I think that they should be slightly more discerning in cases where it's, that guy is slandering me on the internet. Well, it's the freaking internet. What do you want? You know, there's a post about just about everybody on the internet talking about, well, that guy sucks a bag and you know, that guy totally, you know, takes it up the arse for whatever, 50 cents, 95, you know.
A great way to put this into perspective is that you and I, Mark, literally can just kind of sit here and banter, just shoot the shit back and forth until somebody types something we don't agree with in the chat, and we can legally pursue that individual by identifying their personal information and sue them for slander. I think it's giving a lot of people with big heads a lot of authority to cause a lot of unjust hardship to a lot of individuals. That's all I hear from doing that is if I perceive somebody being malicious towards me, even though they're totally within their right of freedom of speech to challenge anything I say, that I can turn around and sue them, and that I can get an ISP or a search engine to back me in obtaining information to identify that individual. Again, should that happen here in the States, I'd be looking for a much more secure email provider so they can go ahead and make my rants without fear of legal prosecution, because I feel I'm in my rights to do so.
Well, I mean, there's obviously you're defended by certain things of the First Amendment, et cetera, but one of the things that's interesting is that technology has us all fooled. And if you don't know, here's some food for thought for everybody listening, whether you're in the chat room or you're listening to this in post. If you delete or format a hard drive, a flash drive, an SD card, that information is not gone. Short of physical destruction, and I mean thorough physical destruction, that information is not gone. Because when you delete something, when you format, none of that information actually goes away. When you format any kind of physical media, what the computer is telling the hard drive, all it is doing, it is saying, from this point forward, these sectors are now writable. There's no checks, no balances, no nothing, just overwrite. So information is constantly overwritten. But that's why it is that so much software exists, you know, disk rescue, disk refragment, things like that. Things that exist to recover lost data. And for those programs that cost you $50, $100, $350 for a disk recovery service, it's because that data is already there. And short of actual physical destruction, and not just like smacking it with a hammer, because there are tons of stories where guilty people have tried to hide their information on their hard drives by destroying it with like a sledgehammer in their driveway. But so long as they can still piece it together and have a freeform reader that can read what was once on there, they can piece it all together, or at least enough to, you know, create a case. So there, you can actually Google this, the proper way to destroy a hard drive.
But if you Google it, they might use it against you now. So if you Google it, don't commit any crimes.
Use a proxy, kids.
Actually, there was an article, I think it was last week, about how the use of a proxy actually makes you seem more incriminating, because they can just subpoena the proxy and say what IPs have connected to you in the past 30 days, 90 days, 120 days. So even they can be strong-armed into releasing the information.
It's funny how you were talking about physical destruction of hard drives. I was reading an article just a couple of years ago that said, start with magnets and end with thermite, and then you shouldn't have any concerns. And I think that pretty much well summed it up. Really awesome about thermite, and I speak of this without fear of much repercussion, because just, you know, YouTube thermite, and you'll find easily 100 different videos of recipes on how to make thermite. Thermite is not illegal in the U.S., and it's incredibly inert. It's basically iron oxide and aluminum mixed together. And, I mean, you can drive around with stuff in your car all day and have no fears of blowing your legs off. It is absolutely inert. It actually takes quite a bit of temperature to ignite it. And a lot of people use magnesium strips to actually start the ignition process. Having said that, what makes it really interesting is if you're pursuing a career where you're doing quote-unquote unquestionable activities on your home computer, you can just take a terracotta pot, fill it with thermite, and keep it on top of your tower until the cows come home with a magnesium strip sticking out of it. If the feds ever kick in your door, just touch off the magnesium, and there's no more physical evidence you even had a hard drive, let alone what the contents therein were.
Except for the willful destruction of evidence.
A lot of us voicing any type of discontent is done very publicly on message boards or on social media sites like Facebook and Twitter and MySpace, where pretty much you no longer even have control over the illusion of whether or not you even said this stuff. I mean, if you're being malicious on Facebook, or, and you know, again, it harks back to the issue of what these people were saying through Gmail in Canada. So clarify, it wasn't the UK, it was Canada. This information can become available and accessible. So it's more than any images you may be downloading. Somebody else also has a record of your activity on the internet, websites you visited, and again, forums you post on. So you can, you know, melt out your hard drive to kingdom come, and they'll still have enough of a trail with the cooperation of search engines and your ISP to lead right back to your doorstep. So basically, you're a fool to do anything foolish.
I was just talking to Jack in the background. You realize that I'm going to have to give this part of the show like the Fight Club treatment, right? Because when they were filming the How to Make Dynamite scene, they realized in the script, like, wait, do we actually make dynamite this way? So they had to call a bomb squad. And they're like, do you make dynamite this way? And they go, yeah, yeah, that's the exact recipe right there for homegrown dynamite. Like, oh, we should probably cut most of that out. All right. So live on the Big Ball Broadcast, the Anarchist Cookbook, and in the post-produced show, nothing.
Well, again, you know, it isn't something that's illegal for anybody in the U.S. anyway to possess. It's not an explosive. It doesn't generate any force. It just it produces high temperature, so it's really not considered risky. And it's a material that you can buy pre-mixed at like any welding store, because it's used commercially, especially to fuse railroad tracks. So, I really don't have any fear of any repercussion discussing that. If you melt your own face off, then you're an idiot. You know, you can't blame us for being an idiot. Just keep that in mind.
Just make sure you don't pay with cash, because that's going to look really bad. Like, would you buy thermite cash? Oh, no. We're going to have to get this person.
I don't know. I'm a strong believer in paying with cash, because if you pay with a credit card or a debit card, it's a permanent record of that transaction. If I pay it with cash, at least I can try to wiggle out of that one.
That's the point.
Yeah, but you got to prove that it was me paying with cash to do it to begin with.
That's what cameras are for.
I've watched enough crime drama where I think I can talk a jury.
That's what I was just saying to Mark. I was like, God damn it, Law and Order. You're telling people how to destroy evidence. No one knew about bleach before Law and Order came out.
Well, it's funny because quite a few convicted felons have come out and said, particularly with both the advent of Cops, which is definitely the best of the best of the reality TV shows out there, and dramatizations like CSI, all you're really doing is breeding smarter criminals. So we'll save that for a debate for another episode. Okay, because I'm a little creeped out right now. There's something like ominous floating in my drink, and I don't know if I should drink it. Like, you take that chance? I don't know. It's pretty ominous. It's casting a shadow on the bottom of my clear liquid here.
Does it have a message in it?
I'm not drinking f***ing alphabets. What do you think?
Does it say, ooh?
Ooh.
Peter, those are Cheerios.
All right, let's get to this last story before it's premature post-show ejaculation.
The 9 worst types of podcasters brought to us by Topless Robot. It was said by Andy Warhol that in the future, everyone will be famous for 15 minutes. Now that we're actually living in the future, this should be corrected to everyone will get 15 podcasts. The podcast, which allows one to essentially create their own audio or video show for free with minimal setup, is a wonderful way for people to share their thoughts, interests, and opinions on a multitude of subjects. Unfortunately, like everything else on the internet, 99% of people who make podcasts shouldn't be making them. Here are the 9 horrible podcasters you're likely to listen to before you actually manage to find one of the good ones. Number 9, people who never stop talking. Would you like to hear someone talk on and on and on about nothing in particular? Well, that's almost every podcast. There's not even a blessed commercial break to end the monotony. It's just one run-on sentence after another, meandering from one discussion about Star Trek to who should really be playing Green Lantern to why they're losing their hair at 35 in their parents' basement. Hey, Kyle doesn't live in his parents' basement. It's kind of like listening to Jimmy Stewart's filibuster in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, except you just want Mr. Smith to die with blood shooting out of his nose.
Number 8, nerds with incredible narrow interests. Well, you know, there's a lot of podcasts out there to broadcast to anyone, even if it's just shouting into the very loud wind. You can lose your goddamn mind just searching for a podcast on a subject you think nobody would possibly ever have a podcast for, finding out the podcast exists, and then killing yourself by listening to it. Do you want to listen to a whole podcast about the continuity in Star Trek? Do you want to listen to a podcast about two-wheeled RC cars? Do you want a podcast literally full of white noise? Ice Tune Store has your back, and the knife to plunge it into.
Number 7. People who can't work the recording equipment. This is totally not me. You may think the public access shows are low-budget disasters, but just take away the studio and the equipment and the people who can check, and you have what are most podcasts. It's a tinny cacophony of voices recorded through a laptop microphone, fed through Skype, and played back on what sounds like a wax cylinder covered in dirt. Then, of course, the volume ranges from so silent you think perhaps your iPod is broken to, oh my god, I'm deaf! All within the same 10 seconds of one podcast.
Number 6, and again, this certainly doesn't apply to us, crazy people. There is a place where other people might hear a person speak, then there is a good chance that a crazy person is there. If you think there are nutty people on AM radio, just imagine what it's like without the worry of losing advertisers. Oh, if you want to hear the disturbing shrieks of the damned, then by all means do so. Learn on about random mumblings of letters and numbers, or how Hitler was the greatest Christian of all time, or how or how crystals can solve the problem, or... Or how crystals can solve...
Can we not edit that?
No, that's staying in. That's totally staying in. Continue.
I want to know how crystals can solve World Badger. What the hell is that supposed to mean? Actually, if there's one good thing about these podcasts, at least the people are being true to themselves.
Number 5. Girls who get too many listeners because they're girls, and the internet fame has gone to their heads. The internet is full of lonely guys who will just as readily listen to the sounds of a feminine voice as a cocaine addict will attend the Pitchfork Music Festival. Therefore, a woman-led podcast will get at least double the listeners' podcast featuring a guy, and triple if the woman even mentions anything remotely sexual and or video games. That's, yeah... No effort is required on the part of the woman, which just furthers the idea of women equals things to masturbate to. There is a balancing act to be had, though. The woman doing the podcast must never reveal any personal information or risk being grabbed in the night by a giant, sweaty, no-neck man with a Joker face paint and a Batman shirt sealed away in a giant plastic bag with backboard.
Here we go. Kyle. Number 4. Anyone who reads listener mail. If a podcast seems like a lonely affair, then listener mail is there to tell you of an even lonelier affair. One where people with apparently too much time on their hands not only listen to a podcast, but write in to voice their opinions. It's almost always starting with, I love your podcast, and then unfurls maximum griping. Clearly that one thing you read 2 weeks ago was completely wrong. According to my encyclopedic knowledge, the mail will say, either as an email read by the host, or with maximum distortion as a voicemail recording. I understand your opinion, and maybe I made a mistake, and thanks for listening. Oh god, I wish Kyle were here. The host will say, I understand your opinion, and maybe I made a mistake, and thanks for listening, the host will say. It is one person thinking their voice is so important that it needs to be heard writing to another person thinking their voice is so important it needs to be heard, and both are disastrously wrong.
Which leads us directly into number 3, totally applicable to the Big Ball broadcast, Idiots with Delusions of Grandeur. Having a podcast and having people listen to it does not make you a celebrity, or a guru, or a person who even deserves a television show, or, in our case, a minor deity. It makes you a person who records their voices into a device to be thrown out into the endless shouting winds and other voices. Yet some people don't realize this, and think perhaps their voice comes down upon high with lights and theatrical effect, and will tweet and Facebook with multiple exclamation points about their upcoming episodes, and have you possibly purchased a t-shirt mug collection of off-key songs from their Cafe Press store?
Number 2. Unfunny people who think they are funny. If you think you are funny, then podcasting is like open mic night, except there is nobody to tell you that you suck. Podcasting allows one to simply have a stage surrounded by one-way mirrors with the mirror side facing the stage. People speak, and they never have to take criticism if they don't want to. Hence, they can put as many jokes about Obama drinking lattes, songs about farting on dates, and shouting about Michael Jackson's penis as much as they want without someone running up to them and slapping the microphone out of their hand. Take a look at the category of comedy and download a few of the winners if you don't believe me. You will hear a lot of unfunny people laughing at themselves.
And the number one worst type of podcaster is whiners. Oh my gosh, my life is so horrible. No, it's not. It's not horrible. Not even the slightest horrible. Would be more like, I don't have money for a computer or internet connection or food, and I have to stay away from the window in fear of sniper bullets. That's horrible. Your inability to pay a parking ticket for your Vespa is not horrible. Nor is your Xbox red ringing. Nor is the choice of Ryan Reynolds as the Green Lantern. Nobody wants to hear you bitch about any of these subjects. Shut up, shut up, shut up.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was the Big Bod Broadcast, bringing you a podcast that is almost none of these things.
Proudly so.
Do we fall into any of that stuff, Steve?
Just all of them, you know?
Yeah, unfortunately we're guilty of some of that stuff. Like, I'm definitely the run-on guy. And,
I get no problem with reading email from our listeners. I think it provides valuable feedback. I do think our voice reigns from on high, so, you know, it's all good there.
Yeah, totally. We're gods among men. We associate with a voice actor. What does everybody else do?
Oh, I'll save my comments for post-show.
Jack, any closing comments here?
Without further ado, until next time, this is Otherworld Steve.
This is Mark Swent.
See ya!